According to our next guest, for decades now, American voters have been convinced to support public policies that only benefit those in power. But how do the powerful extract consent from citizens whose own self-interest and collective well-being are constantly denied? Why do so many Americans seem to have given up on quality public education, on safe food and safe streets, on living wages, even on democracy itself? All questions asked by Corey Dolgan in his new book, Kill It to Save It, An Autopsy of Capitalism's Triumph Over Democracy. Corey Dolgan is professor of sociology and director of community-based learning at Stonehill College in Easton, Massachusetts. Again, the name of the new book is Kill It to Save It, and we welcome Corey Dolgan to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Sure. Thank you, Joe, for having me.
What brought you to this subject of looking at the fate of capitalism?
Well, you know, it's funny because on one hand, the book starts off very autobiographically, and it's certainly something that I've been trying to wrestle with and probably really hit home as I watched my students over the last couple decades and watching kind of their dwindling set of expectations and the ever-expanding amount of stress and struggle that they were going through trying to make their way in the world. It really ended up with a sense of great disappointment, perhaps in myself, and I don't want this to turn into therapy. But, you know, in a country in which I grew up in, thinking that there was this inevitable movement forward, this kind of progress when it came to social justice and economic equality, and that, in fact, during my professional lifetime, I've seen a great U-turn in both of those areas. So I was really trying to flesh out kind of what's happened, or as I say in the book, what went wrong.
So for you, what was really integral in getting to the crux of that, of what went wrong?
Well, in large part, it's been, as I suggest in the title, the triumph of capitalism over democracy, the dwindling opportunities that people really have to change policies in which the kind of the corporate power and corporate desire for profit has really become not just front and center, which for a capitalist nation, I think it's always been front and center, but now it's really completely triumphant. And the ability for people to organize collectively to fight for civil rights or labor rights has been dwindled dramatically. And I think that in trying to look and find the right metaphor and the right framework for explaining it, I kept going back to the adage from Vietnam about kill it to save it. And really the title comes from the notion that in order to save Vietnam from communism, we actually had to destroy the country and its people. And this notion of really almost self-destruction when it comes to so many of our contemporary policies about the public good and public institutions.
You're fairly specific in the book in talking about how this political and cultural consciousness in this country being rewired really happened since the Reagan era, and really pinpoint it to that decade.
That's right, and although I would probably go back just a couple years, but I think that the loss of the war in Vietnam, mm-hmm. You know, Carter's crisis of confidence speech in the late 70s is pivotal in the sense that he really lays out what has changed so drastically in the United States, and this loss, and not necessarily a bad thing, this loss of arrogance, but also this loss of, you know, the idea that people were judged on their hard work, not on who they, you know, kind of how much money they had. People were committed to the public good as opposed to their own private consumption. And this kind of loss of values and loss of confidence in what America as a country stood for generated in him this sense of reflection. He didn't have much policy-wise to offer, and of course then loses to Reagan, who promises this kind of historical amnesia, the idea that we don't have to deal with all these crises. Our identity crisis is simply a loss in faith in our arrogance. It's a loss of faith in allowing us to simply be free to compete and be the best in the world. And so, of course, he beats Carter rather soundly, and then institutes policies that really take us away from the New Deal, away from the idea of the public good, building public infrastructure, investing in public education, and essentially, I believe, starts us on the policy road down to where we are today.
Talk a little bit about this, because I found it fascinating in the book, but that during that election and after that crisis of confidence speech, the worldview that Ronald Reagan offered as an alternative, as you just stated, a lot of it a series of myths, and yet he was tapping into something.
Well, that's right, and I think, you know, I mean, myths survive, you know, like ideologies, because there are aspects of it that are true, but even more importantly, myths like religions are based on faith and belief. It's one thing to have faith in God as an organizing principle for setting up values on how we should live with one another. I think it's another to believe that our national DNA and our success as a nation was based primarily on this myth that people in the United States have always been free to work hard and carry out their entrepreneurial intellect and their creative spirit and their dreams. In order to believe that, you have to ignore genocide. You have to ignore the theft of the land from Native Americans. If you want to believe that, you have to ignore slavery and the role that slavery played in building the South and financing, you know, a lot of the wealth in the North. So once you start ignoring these aspects of our origin myth, you can probably go back to it time and time again and believe that America has always made it because of its, you know, great hard work and freedom. But that freedom has always been based on the enslavement and ruthlessness of others.
One of my favorite lines in the book, you said it would be unfair to blame the entire state of our current economic and political demise on Marco Rubio. Why does he so symbolize what you're writing about when it comes to kill it to save it politics?
Well, you know, fast forward, right, from our origin myths to our rags to riches stories. You know, the myth of Marco Rubio, although it was really dismantled early when he initially proclaims that his parents were refugees from Castro's Cuba, and it actually turns out they left a few years before he came to power. But, you know, he suggests that he's an example of someone who's become incredibly successful because his parents worked hard and adopted the kind of American system of values when they came here from Cuba, and that because of his hard work, he became successful and now espouses policies that are about, he said things such as we don't need a raise in the minimum wage because it makes us less competitive. He believes that public education ought to be privatized. He supports, you know, Paul Ryan's budget, the Trump care proposals. You know, he is on the forefront of what's become this very anti-public institution Republican right wing. However, in his own story, it's very clear that his success was based on those institutions. His parents were union members. They much of his childhood was spent in Las Vegas, a union town, and both his mother and father had jobs that that benefited from unions, giving them better wages, working conditions, health benefits, etc. He now is opposed to those kinds of policies and opposed to unions. He was the benefit of very strong public education when he moved back to Florida. Dade County had one of the best urban public school systems and certainly the best bilingual programs in the United States. And he went to a public community college and then the University of Florida, so whose fees and tuition back in those days were incredibly affordable to the poorest and working class people in the state. Those costs have risen dramatically, even exponentially, primarily due to the anti-public sector policies that he espouses. So I find him to be a very unique character. At the same time that he tries to adopt this kind of rags-to-riches story that America relies upon these days as part of its mythology, he's actually voting against the kinds of policies that made that a possibility in the first place.
So the guy who beats him in the Republican primary, among many other contenders, is a guy who's the polar opposite, who said, look, I was born with a silver spoon in my mouth. I've done very well. I'm a billionaire. You're not. Here we go.
No, that's right. Well, you know, it is kind of ironic, and I suggest this in the book, that essentially what the Republicans did was at a certain point decide they no longer needed the middleman. And so, you know, when Donald Trump says, you know, I give them all money, you know, and they do what I say, really, Citizens United and contemporary politics is more than ever about the corporate sector giving money to politicians to do their bidding. Well, why not get rid of the middleman and just have one of your corporate elite take over the realm of government?
You can read this book and want to bury your head, but your epilogue is is surprisingly optimistic.
That's right. I really feel strongly that as someone who spent a lifetime of organizing and activism, that we really needed a better analysis about how we got to this place before we really can contest for change. What I wanted to do was give us a little bit more of a fleshed out and historically grounded idea about what we need to do based on how we got here and what the landscape looks like. Trump has really crystallized this kill it to save it paradigm, and the fact that he's been met with such strong resistance, whether it was the Women's March or the pro-science march, can you imagine we have to march for reality, that even the media has responded to some degree with a level of investigative journalism that we haven't seen in a while. I was most moved by the airport protests. As Trump crystallizes all that is kill it to save it, I think he suggests that we also need an alternative vision. And I'm hoping that what these movements are able to do is not only coalesce against what Trump stands for, but also begin to generate a vision of what a kind of socially just public social welfare state ought to be.
The name of the book, Kill It to Save It, An Autopsy of Capitalism's Triumph Over Democracy. The book is published by Policy Press, the University of Bristol. Corey Dolgan, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for being with us.
Sure. Thank you, Joe.
Again, the title of the book, Kill It to Save It, by Corey Dolgan. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.